Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Well, welcome everybody. Welcome to the Commonwealth Club of California and our week-to-week program on Monday, July 30th. We're very glad you could join us tonight. I'm John Zipper, the Commonwealth Club's Vice President of Media and Editorial, and I'm your host for tonight. If this is your first week-to-week program, it's something we've been doing for a few months now, and we welcome you to what we like to think of as a bit of an antidote, if you will, to some of the shouting matches you get on cable television sometimes. We wanted to create a program where people could come and talk about politics, could disagree, could have fun, and learn something, too, we hope. So, a reminder, this is a program of political analysis and opinion, so any opinions expressed by any of our panelists, including myself, are opinions only of the speakers, not necessarily of the Commonwealth Club, our members, our guests, our supporters, people who drive by our building, anything like that. Now, this is a special night for us. This is the first evening program we've done with Week to Week. And normally, we will end our program with a 5-minute news quiz. Well, this time, because we've got a full house here, we're actually going to do it a little bit different. We're going to do the full hour program. Then we're going to break for a little bit of an intermission so you can refresh your drink out there, get some more food. Then we'll come back in here and we'll do a competitive news quiz. So we'll take some people and two of them at a time. We'll ask some questions. The winner will get a bottle of wine courtesy of our friends at Barefoot Winery. So it should be fun. And if you win, you get a bottle of wine. If you lose, you at least got to represent your country in this great competition. So let's meet our panelists for tonight. On the end over there is Deborah J. Saunders. She's a veteran columnist at the San Francisco Chronicle, where she also writes the blog for sfgate.com called Token Conservative. And tomorrow morning, Deborah and her husband, Wesley Smith, are going to be guest hosting Dennis Miller's nationally syndicated radio show, and their guests will include everyone from Will Durst to Carla to the author Dean Koontz. So I think that's probably a good reason to turn on your... Well, actually, they're not on a local radio show, radio station, but they are going to be, you will be able to stream it on the internet at DennisMillerRadio.com starting at 7, is that right? 7 a.m. tomorrow, so something to watch out for. In the middle there is Dr. Larry Gersten. He's a professor of political science at San Jose State University. He's also a political analyst at NBC 11, and he's the author of about a dozen books, including his latest Not So Golden Anymore, any longer.
The Rise and Fall of California.
Rise and Fall of California, which our membership team is giving away copies to the first four people who renew their membership in the club tonight. So see our folks outside.
Rush.
We've also got coupons for discounts in the book for the rest of you, so that's something to look forward to. And right next to me is Carla Marinucci, the senior political writer at the San Francisco Chronicle. She's the winner of dozens of national and state awards and a regular presence on PBS's This Week in Northern California. You can follow her on Twitter at C. Marinucci. And if you can't spell Marinucci, I know what that's like, because no one can spell Zipper either. So, after our panel covers the big topics in politics and other news, we want to hear your thoughts. I'll let you know when you can start queuing up for the microphone, which I think we'll be putting in the audience. It'll be in the audience right over here. So I'll let you know a good time to start lining up for that, and we'll try to get in as many of your opinions and questions as we can. Now, on to today's topics. Mm-hmm. The first one is kind of an obvious one, and I have to start by remembering, you all remember Ted Turner, the media mogul. When he was at the Commonwealth Club a few years ago, he was talking about his business success, meeting people internationally, going to other countries, and how he was able to deal with communists, with, you know, all countries in all different areas. And he said, well, here's what you do. You go to another country, you get off the plane, you meet their leaders, and you say, this is a great country, I love this country, it's such a beautiful land, your women are beautiful, the food is great. Then there's the Mitt Romney way. he is having a trip that has certainly provided some joy, I guess, to Democrats watching it, but Deborah, this isn't going to change a single vote, is it?
Let me just say that he did do that in Israel. And everyone's jumping on him for doing that. You know, I'm sort of surprised that Mitt Romney did that, because I don't think that foreign policy is a strength for him with American voters. I think American voters are pretty happy with Barack Obama's foreign policy. I think they feel good about Iraq and Afghanistan. They don't want to be too muscular with Syria and Iran. And so it's a little surprising that Mitt Romney decided that he wanted to do this foreign policy tour. Now, I'm sorry, when he went to London, the Brits were going to jump all over him because he's conservative. That's just, it doesn't matter what he did. Something was going to be wrong. Okay, he made it easy. But but it was going to happen. But again, so I mean, look, he bought himself a week where he's not getting torn apart at home, and that's a good thing when you're running for president this year.
That's really a vacation.
It is. It's like a vacation. It's like going to a spa.
The Jerusalem spa.
Okay. Larry, what do you think about this trip? Does it change any opinions of him?
I think the Great Britain thing is a bit of a joke. I quite agree. Now, you talk about Jerusalem, and the comment he made today about what makes Israel special is the cultural difference. Oh my gosh, he has stepped in it. But he stepped in it with votes he wasn't going to get. Okay?
That's right.
How many Muslims are going to vote for Mitt Romney? Okay, I don't think very many in the United States. I don't think so. So I think that, you know, he hasn't really hurt himself. And I think in some ways he's probably beefed up his credentials with the far right. The Republicans would love to tear away a bit at the Jewish vote, which was 78% for Obama last time, 1% below the average. So it's been very strong. And they think they've got a shot. Look, the Jewish vote, 2%, 3%. But it's of course, gathered in a couple of states, Florida, New York, mm-hmm. to a lesser degree, California, it's important. And if the Florida vote changes because of what he said in Jerusalem, he may have done himself an awful lot of good. And the other point I would simply make is, you're right, foreign policy, nobody's going to care about this trip in 2 months. Nobody's going to even remember he went. Okay? So I think that, in fact, he probably has done himself, I know it sounds strange, I think he's done himself more good than bad.
I kind of wonder about that, Larry, because, I mean, I think this was a well-planned trip. This was supposed to be the easy foreign policy trip. You go to, our best ally. You go to Israel. I mean, Poland. This, you know, what happens when he goes to Pakistan? You know, I mean, this was supposed to be the one where it was going to be a slam dunk. And you saw, I think the problem is that a perception of, the leadership issue is what is being raised here. And from a press point of view, I just say this. When you have, as you had today, Greta Van Susteren complaining about no access to the candidate on her blog, as she did today, saying she felt like an animal in a zoo, all the press being put in a bus and not given any access to him. And he's had this issue a couple of times on this trip, not answering questions about a basic policy. Then I think the question is perception. Is he ready? Is the campaign ready?
Well,
and I think you're right. In the big picture, will this matter? Maybe not. It just does it sort of solidify perceptions people have about him.
We know that some of us view Romney as a captive. I don't think I've seen the real Mitt Romney. I think, who am I supposed to be today? What am I supposed to say? How do I make sure that the far right that I've been cultivating like crazy doesn't abandon me? Because I've had a heck of a time getting a hold of the middle. So much of what he seems to do is so stiff and choreographed. Mm-hmm. Maybe Obama can be criticized for talking down and lecturing us, okay? But what Romney's problem, I think, is that he's very stiff, and nobody can get their arms around this man. You know. By the way, his next foreign policy trip is to the Bahamas and Cayman Islands, so that should be a good one.
That's
you know,
where you put your tax money. It's domestic.
There you go. That's right. I think that's an issue. That's an issue. But it's an issue that goes beyond this trip. Right, it's
yes.
an issue to the construction of the entire campaign.
No, I think you're absolutely right. As somebody who's watched Romney in person, who's covered him, I think that is the single biggest problem, is this feeling of not knowing who he really is. You never see the passion or just spontaneity, it seems like, except when he's with his wife, I have to say. But I mean, that's the issue. Everything seems so pre-planned with him, and I just feel like, and I'm hearing solid Republican voters saying they're just not feeling a connection with him.
That was going to be my question. That feeling is on the Republican side as well. And what was, you can probably refresh my memory, in 2008, the story was that of all the Republican candidates in that election, in that primary, they could all get along to some degree. They didn't like Romney. And, I mean, if you're, what is it about him that truly is making him unable to connect even with people he should be able to connect with?
Well, you know, the politicians are the friendliest people in the world. They really are. It's their job to court votes and get as many people to vote for them as possible. And they just deal with people in a very different way than a CEO type does. He has a corporate structure. And we all wonder what his core beliefs are. Although I actually think, Larry, that what he's talking about now, these are closer than his core beliefs when he ran for governor of Massachusetts. But I'm like other Republicans. I don't feel a real sense of who he is. The way, I mean, you knew who John McCain was.
Right.
It's not always good when you know who somebody is. John McCain, I have a great deal of respect for. I was thinking of Newt Gingrich, but so I mean that's a problem that he has. But it's because when you deal with people who are CEOs, we saw this with Meg Whitman. They're used to having people treat them with a certain kind of deference that with which we do not treat politicians, mm-hmm. and they're used to structuring things in a way that makes them look better than, and let's face it, what do we in the press do? We like to make you look silly sometimes, and we like to jump on you for a stupid comment, and why would they want to give us that? And I think that with Romney, that you had somebody who was he's not a glad hander, he's not an affable person, he's never had to cultivate that, except for this chore of trying to be president. And so that's why he didn't get along with them. He's worked better at it now. The Real Clear Politics has the second book out on this election already. Mm. His little ebook, and they tell the story about how the after Tim Pawlenty was talking about Obamacare,
right.
That everybody was expecting him to jump all over Romney at the debate, and Romney walked up to Pawlenty and said, "Hey, nice to see you, guy." Asked him about his family, and Pawlenty didn't jump on him. And that pretty much ended Pawlenty's campaign at that moment, when he finally had some momentum going. So he can do it, but obviously he doesn't do it with other politicians.
And Deborah, you mentioned Meg Whitman, and I think that brings up a good point, because we in California have seen this movie probably more than any other state. A wealthy business individual running for high office, Al Checky, Steve Wesley, Steve Poizner, Meg Whitman. I mean, we could go on and on, right? And you're absolutely right. There is, a parallel with all of these candidates. They are used to working in the boardroom. It isn't the same as on the campaign trail. And some of them have made the transition when they run for office at a lower level first and can sort of inoculate themselves. But we've seen this numerous times. And with Romney, I think, on the communications front, here's the problem. A 59-point economic plan, how many did Meg Whitman had a, 48-page economic plan? This is, you know, bring it down to what the voters can understand. And still hasn't done that.
But I think people have a pretty clear idea of what Mitt Romney would do as president. I think people have a pretty clear idea as to how he would work.
I think they have an idea about some things, not others. But I think it's his personality. Look.
You don't have to marry him, Larry.
In San Francisco.
Well, you're not going on a cruise with him.
But people need to feel comfortable. They need to feel comfortable with the person they're going to trust. And the issue with Mitt Romney is, I think he's uncomfortable that people know he's rich. he doesn't handle this well. He's almost ashamed that they know he's rich. And I've said this before. I think what he ought to say is, you bet I'm rich. You bet I'm rich. And I want to be president so that every one of you has the opportunity to be rich.
You want him to be Donald Trump?
I want him to. Well, no.
No, I don't.
Just
but
saying.
Look, if you look at, you know, there's the old story from decades ago where Roosevelt met, had a big gathering, you know, hundreds of thousands of people, and he gave a speech, and a reporter comes up to this guy in the crowd who's just beside himself. The reporter says, "Do you know the president?" And the guy says, "No, but he knows me." That's what Romney has to, and frankly, it's a hard thing to do. You know, Clinton does it. Reagan did it, okay? But Romney has none of that. None of it, okay? And he's got to fight a little bit.
You know, he's got to have some of it because he did get elected as governor of Massachusetts in a very blue state. So obviously he's been able to convince people before. We'll see. I mean,
Different stage. It's a different stage.
Let's face it. United States, this race, it's a tough room.
It's toss-up. Yeah. It's a toss-up. Today, it's a toss-up.
Mm-hmm. You know? Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah, Gallup poll, 46, I think it is. We're 100 days out. This is right down the middle.
Well, before we move away from Romney, you're talking about the UK press. Of course, a big factor in the UK press is a big factor in the American press, which is Rupert Murdoch, who has rather sharply criticized Mitt Romney and the campaign. Do you think that could play any role? I mean, of course, he's Greta Van Susteren's ultimate boss as well.
Yeah, right.
Can that play a role in hindering Romney or in pushing Romney to take maybe more, from the Republican point of view, successful, you know, campaign moves? I mean, will that play a role?
Yeah, Murdoch wants him to fire his staff. I mean, he thinks that he's surrounded by people who just aren't of the caliber he'd like to see. I don't know, mm-hmm. and I don't know that I'd necessarily go to Rupert Murdoch for my campaign advice if
mm-hmm.
I were Mitt Romney. So yeah.
And let's remember, this is a foreign policy trip, and to Deborah's point, the first point, a month from now, nobody's going to know where he went. If you asked 100 people a month from now, name me two of the three countries he went to, they'd be stuck. Okay, they'd be stuck. So I think. Right now, it's the middle of summer. There's nothing going on. He takes this trip. Everybody is microscopic about what he's doing.
Well, there's nothing going on except for a completely negative campaign on both sides. I mean, this is a campaign in which we've just ping-ponged from one gaffe to another, and that's all we're covering. I mean, that a lot of times.
Absolutely.
And I think that is the real shame, whether it's, you know, you didn't build it to, you know, I like firing people to, I mean, this is just astounding to me, the amount of negativity. And the New York Times had a great story over the weekend about how, you know, Barack Obama's had 2-1 negative ads, and Romney's had 5-1 negative ads. The president told a story today in an event. I was reading the Pool Report. A little 4-year-old boy sees a picture of him, and he says, "Who's that?" And he says, "This is Barack Obama. What does he do?" He approved this message.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what it's about. We're not hearing the issues enough. We're not hearing their differences on the issues. But a lot of that is on.
Yeah,
us.
The media. I think the media have not lived up to their mandate.
But in those numbers, Carla, remember Obama had something like 112,000 ads to 56,000.
Yeah, that's right.
112,000 negative, 56,000 positive. Romney was something like 50,000 negative, 10,000 positive. Add them up. Obama, the last month, has had three times as many ads out there as Romney. He is trying. It's a very dangerous, risky effort on his part. He is trying to frame Romney now.
Larry, so he's single-handed.
Well, he runs out of money. They're going to start voting in Iowa on September 26th. They're going to start voting in Ohio, I think it's October 3rd, before there's even a first debate. So it's sort of understandable that they try to define
now. The economy stinks. But I'm telling you, it's dangerous because this is a guy who has had high positives when it comes to likability.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
mm-hmm.
like what's going on with the country, but I like that man. And the more those negative commercials go out there, those ads, the more some people are going to say, well, maybe I'm, you know, that was the one thing that was holding me together with this guy. That's why I think there's a risk. I think there's a risk.
That flows right into the next topic, which is the economy and Obama. I mean, it's not a positive for the incumbent president when you have, you know, stubbornly high unemployment, gas prices starting to rise again. Our rate of estimates of economic growth in the country have come down. If you were Barack Obama, how do you make a positive campaign out of that? You can't do it's morning in America. You could say, you know, it's dusk and eventually morning will come in America.
It's 2 in the morning and you're stuck with a whiskey bottle in bed next to you.
Followed by 3 a.m. and you don't lose
and you can't sleep.
I saw the most devastating graphic on CNN today. It talked about, as you know, Bill Clinton is going to give the penultimate address at the Democratic National Convention in Charlotte. That was announced today. And now we have Obama pulling out his old best friend, not really, Bill Clinton, to introduce him. And so what's devastating is CNN had this graphic. By this time in Clinton's presidency, there were 9.9 million new jobs. Obama, we've lost 473,000, I think it is. It's just devastating. And this is a president. And here's the other thing. What is the defense that Democrats always give for why Obama can't really handle, get the economy together and work on this? It's because the Republicans got in his way. Well, Bill Clinton dealt with Newt Gingrich and still managed to get things done. This president is in such a weak position with this economy. The tax-mageddon is real. Not only is everybody in this room going to have a big tax increase January 1 if something doesn't change, it's going to have an effect on Wall Street. It's going to have effect on hiring. It's going to, and companies are going to be looking at their bottom lines, thinking about how they're going to be planning for next year, and you're going to see bad things happen unless, and Bill Clinton suggested what they really ought to do is just extend the Bush tax cuts for a year. That was smart advice. It would at least have, you may not like it, but it was smart advice, which he had to apologize for later. But as long as these swords of Damocles are hanging over employers' heads, this economy is not going to get better. It's just not going to happen.
You know, it's a funny economy because we know in general the economy is in a malaise. No president in the last 50 years has been reelected when the unemployment rate was over 7.8%. We're at 8.2. On the other hand, you have $2 trillion parked out there. $2 trillion. You're talking about companies with corporate profits that are record-setting. What are they so afraid of here? Excuse me. Okay? There's another side to the story. We've got gobs of money out there, and quite frankly, I think there's a bit of a rolling of the dice here. It's a rolling of the dice. Maybe I don't want to try to make the economy so much better right now. Maybe I want to help that transition. I'm not so sure that companies are suffering nearly. Their employees are, because of where jobs have gone and everything else. Companies, I'm not so sure.
You know, I hear this hint that Republicans are holding back from hiring. I don't know how to tell you folks this, but there are a lot of Democrats who hire people, too. This is California. This is a very blue state. Our unemployment rate is over 11%. Folks here aren't hiring either. They don't have the confidence. It's not just these evil Republicans. It's also Democrats who aren't hiring people.
I'm not talking about evil Republicans or evil Democrats. I'm talking about evil companies.
Well, evil companies have to feel that there's a reason for them to start hiring people, and they don't see it. They're afraid.
Is it uncertainty about where the economy is going to be, where regulation is going to be? I mean, that has been
uncertainty slash fear.
Our tax rates are the lowest tax rates we've had in 80 years. Don't give me this 35% stuff, because we all know that 35%, the corporate rate, nobody pays it. Unless you're nuts, everybody's paying a whole lot less than that. Some companies are getting money back. GE got money back last year. Back. You owe us nothing, and here's $3 billion.
It's not working. It's not working, and Barack Obama's not fixing it.
The point I'm trying, well, first of all, we both know any president, whether it's Barack Obama, George Bush, or whoever, can't fix it. They don't get magic wands when they take control of the White
That's
House.
That's right. They work with Congress.
That's right.
But I'm not so sure it's uncertainty. I tend to agree with Larry. I think a lot of businesses have realized they can make their employees do more with less. I told you the story that I was talking to a dad whose son is a very wealthy investment banker who went to his work staff and said, you know, we all, I don't want to hire anybody right now. We all have to work a little harder. You're all going to have to work 12-hour days. And the working mom said, we're not working 12-hour days. We've got kids. Hire somebody else. You're driving the Lamborghini home. You know, I mean, and in a lot of cases, I think a lot of businesses are just saying, well, we've done with less staff. It's working out fine. We don't need to hire other
people. But you don't grow that way. I mean, the truth is you don't. If you're a company and you want to grow, you don't grow by not hiring people. There are a lot of businesses. I get emails from people all the time. They have small businesses. I'll give the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, is an example of something. There are so many mandates in that that employers, and there's set, that's a huge tax on hiring people and giving them benefits. And there are a lot of employers, they're afraid that they're going to just keep getting squeezed and squeezed. And until they feel, I mean, Larry, I get your point about the corporate tax rate. I think we should have a flatter tax that people actually pay. We don't have that. And I don't see this president trying to get that. All I see him doing is saying, I can't get anything done. It's their fault. And I don't think that's leadership.
But when we talk about the presidential race, Brian Williams had an interview with Mitt Romney this weekend and said, what would you do differently to turn around the economy than George W. Bush? And I think he had about a four-point answer, which was more energy investment, education, trade. Essentially, it was the George W. Bush. I mean, it really wasn't a whole lot different. I think that's his problem. We haven't really heard. I know he's got the 59-point plan, but specifically, what would he do different than the last Republican administration? And we really haven't heard an answer.
Well, and couldn't you even say what would he do different that was dramatically different from what Barack Obama has done? Well, I was going to say with the exception of Obamacare, but on the other hand, we had Romney care, so he might have done much the same.
But I think we do understand. I mean, the problem that the president has is he says he wants his solution is to increase taxes on the top 2% of earners. That keeps the government going for less than a week. It doesn't solve anything. In other words, and what are we going to do? We're going to make people who could be hiring people more afraid to do it and more likely to hoard their cash for something that I don't know. I mean, I don't know many Democrats. I don't hear them saying this is going to stimulate the economy. It's going to jumpstart the recovery. They don't say that. They just want it. They want it to be fair. Well, you know, you can have fairness, but you can have less of the pie, too. And that's where he's going. It just isn't working.
Deborah, the way I see things, there are two types of policies. Hello?
I'll get it.
That's the president now. There are two types of policies, substantive and symbolic. When we're talking about this tax stuff, the Bush tax cut's about to expire and what happens, blah, blah, blah. Raising the taxes of those folks who make $250,000 families and up, you're right, it's about a week. It's a symbolic thing. But symbolism in politics, you know this, we all know this, symbolism in politics really resonates with people. And they want to believe that they're being treated fair. And they see these huge numbers that people are making $30 million, $100 million, $50 million, you know, for what? What did you do? Walk to the moon from Earth? And they're saying, this isn't right. So it's a symbolic thing. It doesn't solve the biggest problem, which has to be a combination of spending cuts and tax increases. It's got to be both. You can pick the 3-to-1, 4-to-1. So far, we couldn't get the Republicans to do 10-to-1.
Yeah, that
in one of the most stupid moments of this whole campaign, and
absolutely.
It's hard to pick one.
Mm-hmm.
Okay,
yeah.
There's got to be some combination. They have to be grown-ups, and that goes beyond the president.
But first, Larry, you've got to get the economy back on track, and I agree with you. I think we need to have we need to increase revenue. I think that if you could somehow lower rates but get rid of the deductions in a way to bring in more revenue, that's the way to go. I just don't. I just don't see that we're going to get that with Barack Obama as president. And I don't see how the economy... things are so ugly right now. We're at a pivotal point where... a point of no return for some people who are unemployed. This is not positive. And you can talk about fairness all you want and it's a symbol if I put a gun to your head and don't shoot it. But if you're... Right? But it's a powerful symbol, and if people are not hiring and they're not spending money because they're afraid, all you're doing is hurting your economy for a gesture. It's not smart.
When economist Paul Krugman was here, he was talking about the long-term unemployed, and he was saying, you now have people over 50 who have lost their jobs, very likely may never find another job that paid as well as the last one. Some of them might never work full-time again, not just because of their age, though that plays a part in it, not just because of the changing skills, though that plays a part in it, but, this is a very different recession.
Right.
He's calling it a depression, that we've been through for a long time. So, it's not just batten down the hatches for a couple of years and things swing back up. And I have no answer to this question, which is why I'm just going to throw it out to you guys. But that is a political what? It's a hand grenade. I mean, it's real despair. As Paul Krugman was saying, that destroys marriages. People lose their homes. It destroys hope. And when that happens, in one election you say, I'll vote out the incumbent. When this continues and you have the older folks who can't get jobs, you have this large group of folks who have graduated from good colleges who are, pouring your very overpriced coffee.
Mm-hmm.
And whatever we talk about getting through this election, we're going to have some very important trends that are running through that are, I think, probably very volatile for the next, I don't know how long.
Well, we're really trying to get our arms around globalization. We talk about it, but we don't really get it yet. And there have been an awful lot of studies out there, that show it's not so much that we don't have jobs, it's that we don't have the people and the skill sets matched up with the jobs. And now here's the problem. Okay. Okay, well, there are all these hundreds of thousands of jobs, green jobs, IT jobs, you name them, okay? Lots of them, all kinds. And we've got all these people majoring in whether it's the social sciences or other things or sciences that they can't really adapt. And at the same time, we know that this problem exists, this conundrum. We're taking money back away from education. We're taking back money from training. This makes no sense. Okay? It makes no sense. We need to be throwing more money to get people prepared to do the jobs they can do. And I won't serve if I'm elected.
Well, we've kind of skirted around and touched upon in this discussion the wonderfully titled thing called Taxamageddon. And to define that, that's what? That's the we have two things happening, the expiration of the Bush tax cuts and the setting in of these automatic deep cuts in many
and the
areas.
Social Security
sequestration.
That's the third one. Social Security tax.
Yes, the 2% Social Security tax.
Yeah, okay. And that all happens what at the end of this year, right?
January 1st.
Mm-hmm. January
1st. We'll
have
a party.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, is there anything going on behind the scenes? I mean, are there?
Yes.
The group of six or whatever senators who aren't crazy, who are talking about plans.
I'm not so sure they're crazy.
Gang of six.
They're the ones who aren't crazy. I mean, are there the adults in Washington who are basically saying, we're not going to let it go this far. We have to have a Simpson-Bowles-like plan or something. Or are they going to do brinksmanship straight up to January 1st? Does anyone know?
I think they'll end up extending the Bush tax cuts for a year, and then they'll get to work in January. And I think you will find some adults. I think that people are... whether or not they prevail. I mean, I actually thought that deal with the Gang of Six would work, so don't listen to me.
I think it depends on the outcome of the election. Yeah. If Romney wins, and it's not so unfathomable that the Republicans get control of the Senate, it's just not impossible. I would say it's a little bit of a stretch, but not a big stretch. And if he wins, you got coattails. They keep the Scott Brown seat in Massachusetts, and you grab the Republican seat in Nebraska and whatnot, North Dakota, stuff like that. It can happen real easy. Texter loses in Montana.
Yeah.
And now you've got Republicans basically controlling all the whole show, and I think it's very doable that at that point the Democrats throw up a flag of surrender. You know, I mean, I think it's possible. So I think the point I'm trying to make is, have I depressed enough of you yet? The point I'm trying to make is that I think everybody holds off until November 7th.
You think so?
I think that's what happens.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, let's go local for our next issue. And for those of you who are not following Deborah on Twitter, Deborah J. Saunders, use that code, because she was great to follow during the Ross Mercurini hearing. Good info, great sense of humor. But she's also, of course, been writing about it in the paper on sfgate.com.
Yeah.
And I wanted to kind of start with you on this. I think you called Mayor Ed Lee a bully in this situation. And Mayor Ed Lee, of course, has gotten Mercurini temporarily removed from the sheriff's office while this whole hearing process is going on. What's going on? What's the status, do you think, of that whole effort?
I should give a telenovela kind of intro, since that's what Eliana Lopez is, a Venezuelan actress, Ross Mercurini's wife. When last we visited the couple, they were in the Ethics Committee hearing room in City Hall. So what's happened is Ed Lee is trying to fire Ross Mercurini. The Ethics Committee has to look at it, then the soups. And what we saw recently is, there's an argument, it's a very respectable argument, to say we don't want a sheriff who has been convicted of a misdemeanor. But the mayor went way too far, and he accused Mercurini of being engaged in a cover-up, and he just didn't prove that at all. They had a number of people testifying, and it was just an example of overkill. This story is going to take forever. These hearings have been long and drawn out. On August 16th, I think it is, the Ethics Committee will be meeting. I'm not sure they're going to have the recommendation they wanted. It looks like as though it will not come out until September. And then the soups have to vote on Mercurini, and we'll see what happens. I don't know. I just am not sure how the soups are going to vote. On the one hand, there are a lot of people who are very angry at the sheriff. On the other hand, there are people who think that... I'm one of those people. I just don't think that you go after first. I don't think the district attorney should have prosecuted a man for bruising his wife's arm, and I think that this is just the kind of overkill that one sees. I mean, the political correctness run amok really shows in this case.
And they need 9 votes, yeah. Right? They need 9 votes to.
That's right. That's right.
That's a pretty tall order.
I think there's a probably better even chance that it will happen. But you just don't know in this town. There'll be elections coming up in November.
We've seen this year two big public officials, Bill Lockyer being the other one. These very personal, and we in the media, of course, this is just great for, hits on our gate and everything, but these are really personal stories with a lot, as you mentioned, there's a lot of fine-tuning and very deep emotion that's going into these cases, and they're very difficult to cover, stories.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Carla, because Eliana Lopez testified, and that was just one of the most amazing things I've ever seen. I've covered a lot of hearings in my time. She basically defended her husband, said she wants to come back to San Francisco. They went to before the court. They can now see each other. They've been kept apart for 7 months. And I think that Eliana Lopez's testimony may change a lot of people's minds. People had portrayed her as sort of somebody who couldn't stand up for herself and somebody who had been cowed. And this woman who I saw in City Hall was... A very self-assured person who I think gave a good account of her situation, and it makes it harder for people to represent themselves as her champion when she says, "No, you're wrong."
Briefly, before we move on, if the mayor doesn't get the votes he wants, what do you think this does to him as a mayor, as his ability to get things done and to have a sway on the city council?
People used to think that he was
A consensus builder,
this mild-mannered guy, and he just went overboard on this case, and I think it hurts him. I think this Chick-fil-A thing, where he tweeted this week that Chick-fil-A isn't welcome in San Francisco, it's like, what do I do?
Isn't the nearest Chick-fil-A in, like,
40 miles?
So think twice before you go there.
Don't come any closer, as we said.
So... Yeah, I think it, I think his image has been tarnished this year.
Well, the whole thing's out of control. I mean, you know, they're really the issue's no longer important almost. It's all about egos. It's all about posturing. It's all about, you know, who survives and who doesn't. And Mark Rimi looks as bad as he can look. He can't look any worse. I think the other guys are looking worse by the day.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think a lot of people are saying, aren't there other issues that we can talk about that are a little bit more important?
Yeah. Although I think the Chick-fil-A thing helps him here, for sure.
Well, let's talk about some of those other issues. California, in the presidential election, of course, we're not really in play. I don't think anyone seriously thinks that the state is going to go red, as they say. But we are nonetheless playing a big part in the presidential campaign. We're funding it. We've been called the ATM of the presidential election. Barack Obama, Mitt Romney, come here, get money. I don't have it to give, but we have a lot of millionaires and billionaires who certainly do it. So it kind of gives us the opportunity in California then to watch the national election, the presidential election, but really to focus on some of the state and local things. One of the interesting stories, Carla, you broke recently, is the state of the California GOP, which... That's a shocker that we actually have a GOP in the state. But, tell us, if you will, what's happening.
Yeah, I mean, we know the Democrats run everything here in this state, but the fact is that there are a lot of Republicans who do want sort of a vibrant Republican Party, and I found out last week that the party here is in such debt. It's behind in its bills. It's, you know, of course, it's declining in registration. And even the board of directors of the party was so alarmed that they voted to close the headquarters in Sacramento and lay off people and essentially try to get some kind of fiscal control over what's going on, which is a really tough thing for the party of fiscal responsibility to be dealing with in an election. You're 100 days out. A party is supposed to do things like voter contact, voter registration, get out the vote, and other important things. And when you're talking about House races that are really important to the Republicans, and it's a critical thing. Other people have filled in the gap. You've seen Kevin McCarthy, the GOP whip, come in, and he has just all over the state raising money and working with congressional candidates. You see all a lot of the party stuff now going to the counties that have a lot of money. In other words, the California Republican Party is sort of withering away, registration withering away, and it's going to be it's of concern to a lot of Republicans in the state. There has to be some kind of other voice out there, and I think you talked about the presidential candidates, and you're right. This is part of the issue with the super PACs and with Citizens United. This is part of it. Why is anybody going to give to the California Republican Party anymore when they can give to, Rove or any of these other groups, and it's unlimited and they don't have to say who they are? And that's what's happening. A lot of these parties now are facing, they can't raise money anymore because people have decided to give to these other committees. The Citizens United has created this whole other situation for political parties. Obama now has been here to California 17 times. 11 times to the Bay Area. It just seems like he keeps coming, and it's like every week we have to deal with another visit and that, And now when he comes in, I mean, this is as he does every time, he usually has a big fundraiser, and then he has a $40,000 a head, dinner at somebody's house. And then he has, and this is sort of a new phenomenon, a roundtable discussion with maybe 25 people who pay $40,000 each. And there's no press in any of these events. We don't get to see what they discuss. And I think you should all, be concerned about that. What does the $40,000 voter say to the president? He's our public servant. We should know that. Romney, too, is not great about opening up his events. He did, I think, in Tel Aviv. It caused him some problems. But that's my beef with both of these candidates. This stuff should be open so all of you can hear what goes on in these fundraisers. What they have to say should not be secret. And yet we have to keep pushing them for that, for the right to cover those.
Well, you got a couple of things going here. I mean, one is the right of the press to get into all these meetings. The other is the flow of money. The third is the disappearance of a party. I'd work my way backwards. I think it's a tragedy when you're down to one party. I just do. You know, it's just not right. You know, you've got to, and this, the way our system is set up in this country, it takes too long to go into all of it, most of us know. You know, it's worked on a two-party system. The third party rarely gets anywhere because of the single district plurality thing. It's a two-party system, and when one party is no longer viable, that's dangerous. That gives the other party way too much power and authority. I don't care if it's a party we like or we hate. It isn't right, as far as I'm concerned. Now the question is, what do we do about that, and how has it happened? Well, the Citizens United case certainly has sped things along. It certainly has. And I, you know, a lot of people get mad at me when I say this, and I should be looking for a window in case I have to duck out. I'm not so upset with the Citizens United case by itself. That doesn't bother me so much. What bothers me is the lack of transparency. Somebody wants to write a $100 million check, good, please make it out to me. But if you're not, please let me know who you are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And that's the problem. That's the problem. And so now the parties which used to gather this money, you know, can make your contribution to the Republican Party, and now I'm going to give this candidate money, and we're going to give that candidate money so they can go out and do the kinds of things they need to do. They're no longer collecting that money because these various super PACs and other entities are just circumventing it. So that's leaving both parties rather impotent, much more so for the Republican, and I just think it's a problem.
I think the state Republican Party, though, I don't think the problem is so much campaign finance as the fact that it's just becoming more and more irrelevant.
In what way?
This is what happens. We live in a state where Republicans live among themselves and Democrats live among themselves, and they feed the extremes with each other, and they get further and further apart. And there are fewer Republicans. They become more irrelevant. They become more conservative than most voters. I mean, that's what happens within these organizations. And I think the party's just lost its way. I have to say, I tend to support state parties and want them, but I'm not real heartbroken about what's happening in Sacramento, because I feel that the state Republican Party has lost its way, and that if somebody wants to find a... And I don't see any way back the way that the election bylaws have worked and everything else. I just don't see a way back. If people want to set up some kind of third-party thing, which they could have done before Citizens United, then let them do it, because the state party is just off... It's made itself irrelevant.
But isn't it? Would you agree that it's made itself irrelevant because the let's call it the heart, the leadership is so far to the right? I'm not talking about conservatives.
No, I know.
And most Republicans I know are not nearly as far to the right as those that are in the legislature. Now, I know a lot of Democrats that are far to the left, but I know a lot of Democrats that are in the legislature that are moderate Democrats, a ton of them. Mm-hmm. And yeah, there are liberals driving it, but they're moderates. We see fights all the time. But for the Republican side, it's just the conservatives or more conservative or even more so. And I just kind of think that the party leadership has lost much more touch, is less in touch with mainstream Republicans than the Democrats. They have more of a smattering.
I want to meet some of these moderate Democrats, but...
What you're saying is that the top two primary is bringing up some of those moderate Democrats.
That's what I was going to say. The top two primary is,
And let's take the Pete Stark race. House in the East
race.
Bay. It's a good example of
that. It's my favorite race.
He could never have been defeated, or, I mean, we don't know if he will be, but, I mean... by another Republican, but a moderate Democrat is posing a very strong challenge to him in the East Bay.
That's right.
In another race, let's look at the statewide race of Dianne Feinstein. She's running against someone probably most people. How many of you, raise your hand if you know who Dianne Feinstein's Republican challenger is.
Yes.
There we go, one.
Can you name
one out of 250? That's pretty good.
Yeah.
And to be honest, I before today in Wikipedia, I wouldn't have known. So, I mean, what's going on with that race? Is she going to just cruise through it?
Or? This is what's so fascinating, though. So the woman's name is Elizabeth Emkin. She's from Danville. And
she'll still be living there in...
But here's what's fascinating. Nobody knows who she is. Guess what? Dianne Feinstein got less than 50% of the vote in the primary.
That's right.
But she was up against 24 challengers.
Okay, but so what? There were 24, you know, midgets. I mean, there were 24 people nobody had ever heard of, and people were still angry enough, and there was enough of a protest vote. And look, she's like the Shirley Temple of California politics. Everybody loves Dianne Feinstein. When she comes in under 50%, that bespeaks a kind of anger at the establishment that really could be dangerous to the Democratic Party if there were good Republican challengers. And there are some, and there are some races where they exist. And Elizabeth Emkin's interesting because she's not your... I mean, we had Meg Whitman and Carly Fiorina 2 years ago. This woman's an activist, went out and raised some money. She's an autism activist. And she really worked hard at it. And maybe the fact that she isn't your sort of money bags kind of Republican business person turned to politics person, maybe that... if she could raise money this time around, would actually make people look twice at her. She is different than she is a different candidate. She's not an establishment candidate.
Well, very good.
Are we aware that Colleen Bernal of Sebastopol was also set to run against Feinstein, but her daughter was murdered 4 weeks ago, and so that didn't happen? And maybe we've reached a point in time where we sort of acknowledge that the entire political animal is sort of corrupt. And maybe we should honor what the French gave us, that Statue of Liberty, the Statue of Liberty. And maybe we should do as the French and have ourselves a nice, big, beautiful general strike while we have ourselves a party and shut down the corruption, knowing that California is the most powerful state in the country, even the world. And we have the ability to do that. My name is Peter, and the authority be mine to say as I do, and the authority be ours to make this come true. The corruption is everywhere. So why don't we unplug the darkness so we can unplug the light? We have the power and the authority to do this. How is it that in France, the students and the labor shut down the whole country in 5 minutes, and any problem is solved in 3 days? Well, but over here, all we do is demonstrate and do a whole lot of nothing.
Well,
right here is a lot of power.
Let's see what folks have to say then. Let's open up the mic. This is actually what we're going to do right now anyway. So anyone who wants to join him at the mic and let's see how many folks we can get your comments, your questions.
I'll just finish off by saying thank you very much, and that a 40-day strike where we say no más trabajo and no más the schools shows D.C. and the world where nobody's fools. And why are we paying taxes if it's sort of designed to pull away the future of our children and grandchildren?
Okay.
It's time for us to be who we are and be a little angry about it with a power of love that's so fierce, all those illusions will surely be pierced. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Next person, please.
Okay. I have a question for anyone who's interested. this is something that really surprised me, coming from a retired judge who was in the position of being a mediator in a landlord-tenant case. I was on the tenant side, and At the very end, when it was all over, I think he was trying to cheer me up a little better for now doing better than I thought by saying, someday this city is going to be the most conservative one in the whole state. And the reason he said that, or what he told me, was that because there's an increasing influence on the part of many Asian people in particular, that we've started to turn or we're about to turn in terms of the flavor of or the preferred ways of looking at things in San Francisco by the majority of people.
That's turning the politics kind of more conservative over time?
Right. So I'm just wondering if any of you would like to comment on that, even if it's just you think it's not a realistic possibility, or might he be onto something?
Do you see anything like that in San Francisco?
I think it's probably not in our lifetime,
I'd say.
In my dreams. But I do think that the economic vitality here, you've got a lot of new innovators, the tech companies, a lot of new wealth coming in, and a lot of The Chronicle building, which used to be filled with the Chronicle, is now one floor of the Chronicle and three floors of a tech startup, rich guys who show up in limos every day. So I think...
But we're not jealous.
We're not part of it. Yeah, right.
And you're certainly seeing the effect of that if you're either trying to rent or buy a house these days in San Francisco.
Yeah, so that may, you know, that may change the political... But I don't think in our lifetime, but it may.
We're talking about a state that has been changing even faster than the nation when it comes to race and ethnicity.
Yeah.
And I will say something that most people won't admit publicly, but will say privately. We're having a hard time with it. We're having a hard time with it. We're having a hard time. Whites, particularly white males, are running crazy because they're running out of them. Right? I'm now on the endangered species list. Women are in a majority, you know, yet have not achieved the status they would have indicated by the numbers. Minorities coming up like crazy that do well economically and certainly are dropping out of flies from the schools because of the way the laws are written, which propels a system that has a disproportionate percentage of people dropping out who are non-white while whites go on. You put this all together, folks, this is not a picture of kumbaya, okay? And we are having a hard time adjusting to all of this. And I think we're talking about several generations in the making. Even these state laws that we see being made now to come up with ways to make sure that people are really who they say they are, you know, show me documentation. Some of that makes some sense. But some of that is so overboard that it smacks of racism as a way to depress the vote. And, you know, you can get away with that for a while, a generation or two. But in the end, if we don't find a way to really blend, that will be a source of our implosion unequaled by any other.
Okay. Yes, sir.
Okay, two quick questions. One of the early ones you dealt with and one of the last ones. One's national and one's local. For the lack of personality that Mitt Romney has, would the vice president be a nice 1-2 punch or whatever you want to call it if he picked the right person who could really talk good? And so,
Deborah?
Yeah, go ahead. Your second question?
The second question about Mercurini is, let's not kid ourselves. He sat on the city council for 4.5 years. He needs 9 votes to vote him out. Why are we even doing this? He must have a few friends left there.
They can't talk about it, so we don't know. And if you ask, they're not talking about it. But I know people who have tried to count the numbers. They don't come up with. I hear 2-3 names of people likely to vote in his favor. It's tight.
I'm just speculating.
But no, I hear your point. You would think that, but maybe Ross Mercurimi's made a lot of enemies in the course of his career.
If Mayor Lee needs 6 or even 7. But 9, I don't think so.
Yeah. I'll say.
Okay.
Yeah. We'll
and on the, on the vice presidential pick, you heard Dick Cheney today say that Sarah Palin was a mistake. You're not going to get any fun, interesting pick by Mitt Romney.
He's going to pick the most boring white guy he can find. It's going to be Rob Portman.
There's some real hotties out there.
Timpalenti is getting a lot of talk.
If he picks the guy who backed down because he asked about his family before a debate... I'm going to be a little ticked off, okay? I thought Timpalenti was a very good candidate up until he wasn't. I mean, I thought he was a governor. There are a lot of good things to say about Timpalenti, but the way he campaigned in 2012 isn't one of them.
Well, Portman, of course, has great ties with Congress.
Senator
from Ohio. It's a key state. Romney doesn't win unless Romney gets Ohio, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And it's doable. And he's very popular there. And frankly, I mean, you know, I'm not an inner circle, I'm not an outer circle, I'm no circle. But I like Portman for him.
There's a couple of young guys that are just wowing me. I think one's the governor of Louisiana.
Bobby Jindal. Yeah, good. He's good. And Paul Ryan.
Every
young guy, I love Paul Ryan.
Paul Ryan in a minute. But Paul Ryan would overshadow him.
Yeah. That's the problem.
Thank you, sir.
And that was a good question about Mercurimi. Yeah. Maybe you're right. Maybe what I'm hearing from some of these insiders is it's not true. I don't know.
Yeah, well, we won't know, though, until they take the vote.
Yeah.
Next question, sir.
Thank you. This is for Deborah and Romney. Help a liberal pick out the points of why, the good points of Governor Romney. If you were asked to come up with 5, 4, 3, whatever you want to, talking points on the positives of Governor Romney, cutting away the blogs, the sound bites, the trips, all of the things that you talked about when we started, you now get to be the advocate. Give us those 2 or 3 or 5 talking points that you would, the elevator speech, if you would, of why he's a good choice for president.
Thank you. I think he'd be very good with the economy. I think he does understand what he has to tell employers to get them hiring. I think he understands a lot of the, I think when it comes to regulations, and I think he has a very good understanding of what holds the economy back. And that's, look, I'm not the biggest Mitt Romney fan, but I think on that score and when I look at what this country needs, I think he's the person. So I'm only giving you one answer.
And he's a fixer. He's a fixer.
Yeah, he is.
Okay?
Yeah.
I mean, people skewer him for what he did at Bain Capital. But his job at Bain Capital was to make companies work well. If it meant taking them apart, you took them apart. If it meant putting them together, and the guy was a total success there.
Do you know what the average rate of return was every year over, average rate of return over 15 years? And this is from the two Boston Globe reporters who wrote a book on him, 85%.
Now
this guy, I know, it's like, can I give him my 401k? This guy understands how to squeeze results.
You're saying the wimp factor is unfair.
Yes, Newsweek is calling him a wimp on the cover of the
paper. But he asked for good the reasons why.
No, that's fair.
Okay, yes, sir.
If he is so smart and he understands everything so well, how come he could praise Israel's health care system and say that it was the lowest cost system in the world, I would say, and not point out that the Israel system is mandated and socialist.
That's a very good point.
I'm not answering that.
No, you're right. Yeah, he was pointing out that they spend 8% of their budget or GDP, on it, as opposed to 18 or something on ours.
Excellent point.
You can have the last word. Short, though. We're going to have to break for the...
Thank you very much. I'll be brief with a couple of questions to the audience. And again, I believe we are the most powerful people in the country. One, is anybody here familiar with NSA's major, actually General Michael Aquino?
John does the news quiz. You can't. Yeah. You cannot poach on John's turf. He does the news quiz.
Yeah. Why don't you come up afterward? We can look at that because I have to do the news quiz after this. So.
Okay. Well, just two more questions.
Well, I really think we need to break.
Look up Michael Aquino and the Psy Up to Mind War, the psychology of victory, which actually was supposed to be dealt with the opposing enemies, but has been imposed upon the American public to maintain subservience.
Folks, we need to wrap up our discussion here. Remember, in 5 minutes, we're going to come back here for a news quiz, chance for some folks to win some nice bottles of wine. So go out, get some wine, get some food, and come back, and we'll send this off on a good note.
Thank you all.
Thank you again to our panelists, Deborah Saunders, Larry Gersten, Carla Marinucci, and thank you all.
Professor Larry Gersten.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.